This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up in this Radio EcoShock show, a frank conversation with one of the world's most famous and attacked climate scientists, Dr. Michael Mann, originator of the hockey stick graph of a rapidly heating world. Then we're off to the Solutions Corner with Kristen Olson, author of The Soil Will Save Us. We wrap this triple header with new science about the impact of climate change on European crops. I'm Alex Smith. Dig in. He's a superstar of climate scientists, even though he didn't choose that. Dr. Michael Mann was already a leading American climate expert in 2001 when he became a lead author for the third scientific assessment report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. That report featured a stunning graphic showing global temperature data for the past 1,000 years. It was gathered from a huge variety of measurements by scientists all over the world. Because this graph showed a steep rise upward over the past century or so, it was called the hockey stick. That image and its lead author became the target and punching bag for the fossil fuel industry and a wild bunch of climate deniers. Mann was attacked at his university. He was a target of the so-called Climate Gate hacked emails, carefully timed to damage the 2009 Copenhagen climate talks. It got so bad that Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli demanded an investigation into Michael Mann by the University of Virginia. Thankfully, the university successfully fought off that man in court, striking a blow for academic freedom. Michael Mann sued the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the National Review for their attacks on the hockey stick graph and himself and his science. We'll get an update on that, perhaps. And through it all, Michael Mann has certainly taken on science as a contact sport, appearing many times in media, including debating climate deniers. He co-founded the authoritative voice of science, realclimate.org. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mann also continued his prodigious scientific research to unearth evidence of climate change. His work has won too many awards to list them all here. Dr. Michael E. Mann is Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University. He is part of the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute. He's also director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Michael Mann, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. It's good to be with you.
I'm guessing if we met in 1995, you would be a busy scientist with no idea you would become a climate celebrity and target as well. Did you see this coming?
Well, no, not really. When I decided to major in applied math and physics in college and go on to graduate school in physics, I didn't really envision that I would somehow find myself at the center of one of the most contentious societal debates that we've ever had. And that is because of this graph we published, the so-called hockey stick graph, back in the late 1990s, and it became this iconic symbol in the climate change debate. And so I found myself somewhat unexpectedly, unintentionally, reluctantly in the center of this fractious debate.
It's tempting to talk about the climate deniers, but our listeners are way beyond that. We know it's real. Some of us think it's too late now to avoid wrenching changes to everything for all the species. Michael, have humans wasted too much time already?
Well, we certainly have wasted too much time. We had enough information to act decades ago. By the late 1980s, it was already becoming fairly clear that human-caused climate change wasn't just a theoretical construct. It was happening. We were beginning to see the impacts. And of course, those impacts have gotten greater and the risks have grown since then. And unfortunately, even though the science really was in decades ago, the science demonstrating that the globe is warming, that the climate is changing, that it's caused by human activity, in particular increased greenhouse gas concentrations from the burning of fossil fuels. We had enough information to act at that point. And if we had acted, we would have averted much of the damaging climate change impacts that we have already seen in the form of more destructive hurricanes, more extensive, prolonged drought in the western U.S., more extreme rainfall events, flooding events, you name it. We have seen climate change impacts in the form of more extreme weather of various types, sea level rise, increased drought, increased extreme heat, all of these things taking its toll on our economy, on human health, on our national security. So we've already paid a price, the price of inaction. And unfortunately, that is in part because of a very well-funded, very well-organized disinformation campaign by industry front groups associated with the fossil fuel industry and private fossil fuel interests like the Koch brothers, Koch Industries. Unfortunately, because of their efforts to forestall action and to poison the public discourse, we are now at a point where it is getting late for action. It's late in the game if we are to avert truly dangerous and potentially irreversible changes in our climate.
Just 10 years ago, we had reports like the Stern report in the UK, which accepted greenhouse gases in the atmosphere could be safely reined in around 550 parts per million carbon dioxide or even higher. What does science know about safe emission levels now?
Well, you know, the only safe emissions are no emissions. We are already at a point where we are seeing damaging climate change impacts. And, you know, if you talk to some experts, you'll often hear a couple numbers cited. 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. Right now, we're just about at 400. At pre-industrial levels, we're about 280. So at current rates of fossil fuel burning, we will hit 450 parts per million in a matter of a couple decades, and 550 parts per million later this century. That would be twice pre-industrial levels. We would have doubled the concentration of CO2 in our atmosphere. And one of those numbers I said is 450 parts per million. You hear from scientists when we talk about the dangerous level of human interference with the climate, and you hear the number 2 degrees Celsius, that's 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming relative to pre-industrial. We think that if we reach 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, which again we will do within a couple decades at current rates of fossil fuel burning, we will commit to at least 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet. And if you look at the impacts of that amount of warming, it is reasonable to say that at that level, we have reached truly dangerous levels of interference with the climate, and we will pay the price in terms of the cost to our economy, our health, loss of land, access to fresh water, food production, you name it, across the board. Beyond that amount of warming, we're starting to see, you know, we start to see a fundamentally degraded planet and a fundamentally degraded opportunity for us to, you know, prosper as a civilization.
We hear this 400 parts per million of CO2 these days, but does that include the rising levels of methane and all the other exotic greenhouse gases that humans are churning out?
That's right. And so typically we talk about a quantity that's called equivalent CO2. So it sort of lumps together CO2 and the other greenhouse gases like methane, and even surface ozone, that pollutant is also a greenhouse gas. Nitrous oxide, which is a byproduct of agriculture, is also a greenhouse gas. And if you add together all those greenhouse gases, then you can represent their net impact in terms of the equivalent amount of CO2. And if you do that, it turns out we are already above 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent. So if you put all those gases together, we're already past the 450 equivalent CO2 mark. On the other hand, we have also produced a lot of industrial pollutants known as aerosols, like sulfate particulates that are produced from industrial activity like coal burning. That has offset global warming in some regions. So that has actually sort of masked some of the warming we would otherwise have seen. And if we do transition away from burning of fossil fuels, then we will stop the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. But ironically, we will also cease the very activities that have sustained this additional cooling factor, these aerosol particulates. And so that means that it'll be even a little harder for us to keep the climate from warming above 2 degrees Celsius, because we're also going to lose this factor that was offsetting some of the warming.
We hear a chorus of people who worry frozen methane in the seabed will reach melting temperature and cause a sudden shift of warming. How do you assess the methane risk?
Yeah, so, you know, methane, when we talk about methane, there are two different things going on. There's the methane that we produce, the methane that leaks into the atmosphere, for example, when we engage in fracking, efforts to remove natural gas from beneath the Earth's surface. And in the process of doing that, some of that natural gas, which is largely methane, actually escapes into the atmosphere. Methane is also produced by farming activities, agriculture. It is produced by damming. The construction of very large dam projects also contribute methane. So we are raising the concentration of this other very potent greenhouse gas, methane, through certain human activities. But then there's this other thing that we call a feedback. To be specific, we call it a carbon cycle feedback, and that's a pretty technical sounding term. But what it means is as we warm the Earth, there is this aggravating effect that by warming the Earth, we actually potentially essentially melt some of the methane that was frozen either in the coastal shelves of the oceans or in the permafrost in the Arctic. And that methane is then released into the atmosphere. And so it's what we call a positive feedback, but that's not a good thing. A positive feedback in this case is it's a vicious cycle, which means the warming releases this methane that had been trapped in either the permafrost or along the coastal shelves. That goes into the atmosphere and causes even more warming. And so there is some concern about the possibility that these methane feedbacks could kick in relatively soon. Now, there's a pretty robust debate right now within the scientific community, a legitimate and honest debate between scientists with different viewpoints about just how large a factor that's likely to be. Some scientists don't think, you know, this methane feedback will substantially add to the main factor, which is our burning of fossil fuels and putting CO2 into the atmosphere. CO2 stays in the atmosphere a very long time, many centuries. Much of the CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere will be in the atmosphere for centuries. Methane, on the other hand, has a much shorter lifetime in the atmosphere, on the order of decades or so. And so some scientists say, you know, the long-term problem here really is the CO2 and methane. The discussion of methane, to some extent, they see as a distraction from the central issue, which is the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. But methane is a wild card, and it's something we have to keep in mind, and there is always the possibility that there are surprises that may loom out there, things that we didn't expect to happen because our knowledge is imperfect, because our science is imperfect. We can't say with absolute certainty precisely what will happen, and some of those uncertainties may break against us. It's possible, for example, that these methane feedbacks may be more substantial than many scientists think, and we could be in for even greater changes and more damaging impacts than we currently are able to project with our models. That's worth keeping in mind. Uncertainty is not a reason for inaction. Uncertainty is actually a reason for taking even faster action, engaging in even more urgent efforts to reduce our carbon emissions because of the possibility that the impacts could be even worse than we are currently projecting.
Scientists have told our listeners recently that there have been some big changes in the climate in short periods of time in the past. Do you believe abrupt climate change is possible in the coming decades?
Well, it is. There are, you know, potential so-called tipping points within the climate system, which is to say aspects of the climate where if you push on them even slightly, they suddenly essentially go over a cliff. So even a little bit of a nudge, a little bit of a push can lead to a very large change. And one example that's often cited is the North Atlantic current, known as the North Atlantic Drift. It's an extension of the Gulf Stream that carries warm water up towards Europe into the North Atlantic. And there is evidence from model simulations, for example, that melting of ice could actually end up either shutting down or at least greatly weakening that ocean current system. And if that happens, it can happen very abruptly. It's one of those things that does behave a little bit like a tipping point. You put enough fresh water into the North Atlantic because of the melting of all the ice, and that very light fresh water inhibits, all of a sudden, the sinking motion in the North Atlantic that drives this current system. So that's a possible tipping point. Another possible tipping point, in fact, it's probably not even just a possible tipping point, it's a likely tipping point. It's one we may have already passed, has to do with the West Antarctic ice sheet. There's some recent science that has been published just within the last few months, so it's even more recent than the science in the latest IPCC report, the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These new studies suggest that we have now warmed the southern oceans enough that they are going to destabilize large parts of the ice shelves that currently support the West Antarctic ice sheet. In other words, it may already be, its fate may already have been sealed. There may be nothing we can do to prevent the collapse of a very large part of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And if that happens, then that alone contributes somewhere between, 10 and 13 or 14 feet, somewhere between 3 to 5 meters of sea level rise, which would be fairly catastrophic, especially if it were to unfold on a time scale as short as a century or so. And we can't rule that out. The current estimates are that it would take many centuries for that to happen. We have already set it in motion, but it will ultimately play out very slowly over several centuries. But we can't rule out the possibility that it could play out more rapidly, in which case we suddenly have a crisis when it comes to protecting the major cities of the world, many of which are at or close to sea level and will be either destroyed or fundamentally degraded by that level of that much sea level rise.
As we face a climate crisis, the National Academy just gave a green light to doing more research into geoengineering, like artificially creating more cloud cover. Should we develop that lifeboat tech in case the climate becomes much worse, much faster than we thought?
Well, there has been quite a bit of discussion, and there were these studies that came out. The National Academy of Sciences published two studies last week about, the so-called geoengineering, ways of sort of trying to engineer our way out of human-caused climate change. The report certainly does convey some apprehension about the implementation of these methods, and I have to say I myself am very frightened at some of the schemes that have been suggested, because we could end up doing more damage than if we had not intervened at all. It's sort of the law of unintended consequences. And, I sort of liken myself as a climate scientist to sort of a planetary doctor. We've sort of diagnosed the problem, human-caused climate change. We know its cause. It's increasing greenhouse gas concentrations from fossil fuel burning and other human activities. And we should hold true to the same principle that scientists hold true to. First, do no harm. And in my view, geoengineering violates that principle of first doing no harm, because we could actually end up making things even worse. If we, for example, shoot large amounts of sulfate particulates into the atmosphere to sort of mimic what a large volcanic eruption does, but we do this every few years to try to put enough of these cooling particles into the atmosphere, into the lower stratosphere, to offset the warming effect of greenhouse gases, we could end up shifting rainfall patterns. We could change the positions of the storm tracks. We could actually create worse drought over most of the continents. We could worsen the ozone depletion problem as well. There are all sorts of things that we can imagine might go wrong. And then there are all those things that could go wrong that we haven't yet even imagined. So I myself am nervous about many of these schemes, and I think that they potentially provide a crutch for those who don't want to do the hard work of mitigation. It's tougher, perhaps, but essential to engage in the actions that we know can stop global warming. stopping the emission of carbon into the atmosphere. And I fear that the idea that holding out these geoengineering scenarios is a convenient way for some to sort of sidetrack the discussion of mitigation. It's a way to sort of try to make the argument that, well, we can continue to burn carbon, we'll just do some of this other stuff and it'll all be okay. And there's no evidence that that's the case, that these schemes are safe. There's no evidence that we couldn't end up making things even worse through most of these interventions. Now, some of these schemes are fairly, you know, they're fairly innocuous in terms of the potential consequences. For example, what's known as open air capture of CO2, basically sucking the CO2 back out of the atmosphere through a fairly sophisticated and frankly quite expensive technology, where you're sort of simulating what trees and plants do. They suck CO2 out of the atmosphere, but there are ways that we could do that much more efficiently. And it would be expensive to deploy this, but it would potentially offset the buildup CO2 in the atmosphere, and there are no obvious negative consequences of doing that, other than the fact that it's really expensive to do that. It's really expensive to try to put the genie back in the bottle. Much easier to try to keep the genie in the bottle, which is what mitigation is all about. Stopping the escalation of fossil fuel burning and CO2 buildup in our atmosphere.
Michael Mann, you were attacked for the crime of doing science, apparently, and even the Attorney General of Virginia got into the act. I just have to ask you, as we wrap up our interview today, what is happening with your lawsuit against the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the National Review?
Okay, well, that's a pending legal matter, so I can't actually talk about that. But what I can talk about are the larger battles that I have had to fight against industry-funded front groups who have engaged in attacks against climate scientists like myself in an effort to try to distract the public, to try to cloud the public's understanding of the solidness of the scientific evidence for climate change. And I personally have been subject to, as you allude to, efforts by powerful politicians who were in the pay of fossil fuel interests, who sought to abuse their power by subjecting me to congressional subpoenas and calling me to testify in the House and the Senate in hostile hearings, in any number of ways, both politicians in the pay of fossil fuel industry and front groups and organizations who advocate for the fossil fuel industry have been doing everything possible to try to discredit this graphic that we published a decade and a half ago, the so-called hockey stick graph, because it has become this a very powerful image that demonstrates just how unprecedented the warming that we are seeing really is. And because it was such a potent image, the special interests who don't want to see us transition away from our reliance on fossil fuels, because they profit from it greatly right now, have done everything they can to try to attack my science, often through engaging in personal attacks and efforts to intimidate me personally. And I actually wrote a whole book called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, which is about my experiences as sort of the reluctant and accidental public figure in the larger debate over human-caused climate change. And I try to share the lessons that I've learned and, you know, why I've decided to embrace that role because it provides me an opportunity to do something that I think is very important, to try to inform this critical discussion of what we are going to do about this mounting problem, the problem of human-caused climate change.
We've been talking with one of the most famous climate scientists of our time, Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State University. I want to thank you so much for keeping up the fight and for talking with us through media large and small. It's appreciated.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find links to pretty well everything we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are partway through a show packed with science, bad news, and solutions. It's Radio EcoShock. Don't forget to check out links for this show in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. More scientists say our best and maybe only hope to bring greenhouse gases down is putting carbon back in the soil. Several listeners have asked for more on this big solution. This week I've reached out to an award-winning author and freelance journalist from Portland, Oregon, Kristen Olson. Her book is The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. It's a finalist for the 2015 Oregon Book Awards. Kristen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
All right, now you've written about all sorts of things for some big publications. What brought you to the soil solution for climate change?
You know, I've always been interested in climate change, in agriculture, in food, in gardening, but I really didn't understand the importance of soil health to so many things, including climate change, until a chef back in Cleveland, where I used to live, who was one of those pioneering chefs who were sort of rebuilding the pipeline between local food production and local food preparation. And he told me that he had been talking to some farmers, and they were all talking about carbon farming, this idea that there could be an agriculture that instead of releasing carbon from the soil and releasing carbon that went up to join the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, there could be a kind of agriculture that drew carbon out of the atmosphere and put it, locked it into the soil. And I thought it was just one of the most fascinating, hopeful ideas I'd heard about in years.
It is. You know, it was only about 10 years ago I heard a few experts say the world started warming about 8,000 years ago and agriculture is the reason why. Do we know for sure that human farming started this long-term trend?
Well, I don't know that we know for sure. You know, some scientists have been making that speculation. There are some scientists who have measured soil carbon losses using various techniques and have estimated that we've lost 80 billion tons of carbon from the world's soils. And then another scientist has estimated that because of human land use, so that would be farming but also burning down forests, that humans warmed the atmosphere so much that we averted another ice age 2,000 years ago. But I think it's hard to really button down those numbers.
So loss of carbon from the soil, the atmosphere, really started picking up in the late 1800s. I've seen a photo of a church in Iowa that was originally on level ground, but now it's about 5 feet in the air. So the land around it lost 5 feet of that carbon-rich prairie soil. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, humans with our agriculture, and it's not just modern you know, we tend to think that modern chemical agriculture is the culprit. You know, that I think the most commonly accepted figure is that 30% of the carbon dioxide emissions now come from agriculture. It sort of depends on who's counting and what they count. But it's not just modern chemical agriculture that is so terrible, even though it is probably the worst, the most comprehensive way to ruin soil that anybody's ever come up with. But agriculture in general, when we till, you know, when we dig into the earth, we're exposing all that carbon that's been stored in the earth through the interaction between plants and soil microorganisms. You know, plants, through photosynthesis, take carbon dioxide out of the air and they convert it to a carbon fuel, and they send, you know, they use that carbon fuel to grow, but they also send almost half of that carbon fuel through their roots down to feed soil microorganisms. So plants have this ancient relationship with soil microorganisms where plants give them food energy and the soil microorganisms give plants nutrients. But in that process, carbon is being taken out of the atmosphere and put into the soil. So over millennia, there's been a lot of carbon that's built up in the soil. And when we till, when we open up the soil, when we clear the land, we're exposing that carbon in the soil to the atmosphere, you know, to gases, and it volatilizes off. So, yeah, that's one of the primary ways that we lose carbon from the soil. And it's not just, you know, when the land sinks like that, it's not just the loss of carbon, but those soil microorganisms, one of the things that they do with that carbon that they get from plants is that they create a carbon glue and they create habitat in the soil. So they're creating little spaces in the soil where they can protect themselves from other microorganisms, where they can control the amount of water in the soil, they can control gases in the soil. So good, healthy soil is just like it's like walking on a coral reef. But if you destroy that soil structure through bad agriculture, you know, you're losing all those pores in the soil. It's going to flatten down.
You list poor ranching practices as another cause of carbon loss. Why and what could we do differently?
Well, when humans domesticated grazing animals, we really changed the way they interact with the land. So grazing animals, you know, there have been in the great grassland areas of the world, there have been huge herds of grazing animals before humans domesticated them. And they would move over the land in a certain way because they were afraid of predators. So they would bunch together. They would keep moving. They didn't stay in one place and just eat plants all the way to the ground and kill them. When humans domesticated them and put up fences or had shepherds there to protect them from predators, they didn't really need to have that behavior. So they would stay on the land, you know, they will stay on the land and just graze it down and kill the grass. So it's kind of like clearing the land in another way. When the animals are grazing and they graze down so that they kill the grass, that removes that relationship between plants and the soil microorganisms where the plants are putting carbon through their roots down under the soil. So there are a lot of ranchers now who are changing that with something called holistic grazing. They're keeping the animals together. They're keeping them in smaller spaces and making sure that they move over the land, making sure that they don't stay on the land long enough to kill plants. They're kind of respecting the growing process of the plant.
One of the heroes of your book is Gabe Brown from North Dakota. Could you tell us a bit about him?
Oh, he's an amazing farmer, and he's just an inspiration. He's not just an inspiration to me, but he's an inspiration to farmers around the country and even around the world. Many, many people go there and visit his farm, and he speaks at a lot of farming conferences. So the thing that I love about Gabe Brown is that he didn't go into farming the way a lot of the farmers, for instance, at my farmer's market have, you know, who are going into it for, you know, save the world reasons. They want to do good farming. They want to serve good food. They're very mission oriented. And he just went into it, you know, because he liked farming and he wanted to make a good living. And he began as a conventional farmer, you know, using all the sprays, doing all the tilling. And he made a very, very dramatic departure from that way of farming because it was failing him, especially in this time of climate variation where you can't necessarily count on the rains coming in the way that they have for so many years. And you can't necessarily count on the frosts and the freezes coming when they always did. The land has to be very resilient to keep up with that. And so he lost crops 4 years in a row because of late frost and hail and drought, one reason or another. And he had to give up the kind of chemical agriculture that he had been practicing because he couldn't afford the chemicals anymore. And he started to do all sorts of things differently. You know, he went no-till. He started to employ cover crops to protect and enrich the soil. He started holistically grazing his animals. Anyway, he changed a lot, and he changed going in a direction that many people like to call regenerative agriculture. It's not sustainable. It's not sustaining a sick system on the land. It's regenerating the land. It's actually doing good to the land. And so now he, you know, that was about 12, 13 years ago where he started to make those changes, and he now uses no fertilizers, no pesticides, no fungicides. He doesn't till, uses a little bit of herbicide every 2 or 3 years if he has some intractable issue going on, but he's trying to get rid of that too. But because of all these changes he's made, he doesn't use the bulk of those agricultural chemicals that are used, and he's more productive than the county average. For instance, with corn, he gets 27 more bushels of corn per acre than the county average, but he spends less than half of what the chemical deploying farmers around him are using to make that money. So he's actually making more money than they are. And, you know, just by every measure, his farming has been incredible. You know, the soil carbon has shot up on his land, the way his land is able to receive rain, the way it percolates, the rainwater will percolate down into the soil, has just completely changed. So, you know, he doesn't worry about drought. He doesn't worry about irrigation. He doesn't irrigate. He has no problems with the pest insects that a lot of his neighbors have. And he's really inspired a lot of his neighbors to change. So he's an indication of the kind of farming that can be done, that can raise our food. And I think we're often given a false dichotomy, a false choice between agriculture that produces enough food. You know, we're always told, you know, the planet's going to have 9 billion people. How are we going to feed them? So we're given this choice between an agriculture that produces a lot of food and an agriculture that produces good food, you know, these more boutique farmers at my farmer's market. And what people like Gabe Brown are showing is that, no, that is not the choice, that we can have both.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Kristen Olson, author of the book The Soil Will Save Us, and it's the big answer to solving climate change. You know, I sort of despair, Kristen, thinking we have to convert every farm and farmer everywhere, but we don't. David Johnson of New Mexico State University says carbon farming on just 11% of our farmlands could offset all the emissions of an industrial society. So there is some hope we could actually do this.
Yeah, there's some really exciting science going on, looking at how much carbon can be sucked out of the atmosphere by plants and locked into the soil by soil microorganisms and really start to make a difference. You know, because if we look at global warming and at this legacy load of greenhouse gases that we've got, if we only look at the emission side, we're just fried. You know, there's just no, even if we stopped at this moment, if we stopped all fossil fuel emissions, we would still be sunk, because it's going to take a while for that load of greenhouse gases to break down, you know, for the earth to reabsorb that carbon dioxide. So unless we turn to this obvious technology that works, which is photosynthesis and then that sharing of the carbon that plants do with soil microorganisms, that put locking that carbon into the ground, unless we turn to that proven technology from nature, we're not going to be able to draw down that load of greenhouse gases. It really is. It has to be considered part of the solution.
One question I've heard is, will the carbon stay in the soil long enough to matter? What do you think?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, once we get the carbon into the soil, we have to continue not to disturb it. So that means continuing with no-till agriculture, continuing to keep the soil covered with plants. It's not hard to keep the carbon down there.
On February 23rd in Los Angeles, there is the Urban Soil Carbon Water Summit. What is that?
It's a conference, a really exciting conference that will bring together people from around the world to talk about applying these ideas of using the soil as a solution, applying those ideas to the urban setting. You know, because it's not just farmers who have a role to play. Farmers and ranchers have a role to play in returning carbon to the soil. But we can do that in cities. There's a lot of permeable spaces in cities, a lot of places where the soil is exposed, a lot of places where people grow things. So many, many opportunities in cities, and that's what this conference will be exploring.
Why do you include foodies as possible soil carbon activists?
I think we're in a really hopeful time where so many people, their concerns mesh, and they're meshing right over the soil. So farmers and ranchers who, you know, want to make a good living and want to make good food and want to protect their land, they're focusing on soil. Foodies who want good food, you know, are understanding that really it's not just about good plants. You know, there aren't going to be good plants unless there's good soil. So people are meshing there. And also, I mean, I think another mesh, another place where there's a cross-section of interest and enthusiasm is environmentalists. You know, environmentalists for so many years just thought about that preserving wilderness was the way to maintain or achieve a healthy planet. But no, you know, I think so many environmentalists, in fact, I think every major environmental organization now has people working with agriculture because they understand that in the spaces that humans occupy, we have to make those really healthy spaces. We can't just give up on those spaces. But foodies, you know, people who eat food, we vote with our food dollar. We have a tremendous influence on the way food is produced. That's one of the reasons that foodies have a big role.
Have there been new developments since you wrote the book that you would like to tell us about?
Things are just happening every day. Almost every day it seems like I hear of some new group that's focusing on soil, groups that are springing up in urban areas like ReSoil Sacramento and Kiss the Ground in Los Angeles, new groups of farmers, you know, meeting and talking about their new techniques. I was invited to, back in December, I was invited to the first global soil biodiversity conference in France, and that was a really exciting sight because, you know, I think that the field of soil science was a pretty quiet one up until, you know, maybe the last 10 years, when really there became this infusion of interest to look at not just the chemical and physical properties of soil, but the biological process, you know, the biological part of soil, the life in the soil. And there's this huge infusion. So there were 700 people at this conference, and I swear that 70% of them were under 40. And a lot of them were under 30. You know, there were just a lot of young scientists there exploring these interactions and complex relationships going on in the soil and relationships between the soil, organisms, and plants. And this is all really exciting, hopeful science. It's kind of, the soil is the kind of the last frontier. It's been difficult to study for so many years because we haven't had the science and the technology to do that. But there's really exciting science and really exciting new brilliant people doing it.
Kristen, please tell us your website address, and also, do you have a Facebook page or a Twitter handle to pass on?
I do, and it's all just, you know, my name. I didn't get creative with a Twitter handle, so it's just my name. It's at Kristen Olson, KristinOhlson. And my website is the same. It's www.kristinolson.com. Anybody who Googles my name can find my website.
Great. Well, our guest, Kristen Olson, is a freelance journalist, author, and fiction writer living in Portland, Oregon. She's written for the New York Times, Salon, Ms., and many more, including the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper where she used to live. She's won awards for her science writing. I would really like to thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock today.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
One more to go. In the past couple of years, there has been a tidal wave of warnings that the world cannot feed the extra 3 billion people expected in the next decades. In fact, with the impacts of climate change, we may not be able to feed the current population, which we're doing a pretty poor job at as it is. We are not talking about hippie bloggers who say this. Many voices of worry come from people like Greg Page, the conservative executive chairman of the Cargill Food Empire, from investment advisors like Jeremy Grantham, and from the Pentagon. That means it is time to talk with the scientists about what we know and what we don't when it comes to climate change and food stress. It will take a series of interviews and programs to do it. We start this week with new science about climate and the stagnation of food production in the heavily populated European Union. Our guest is Frances C. Moore. She's close to a PhD at Stanford while working with the MacArthur Genius Award-winning scientist David B. Lobel. Frances is the lead author in two key parts of the puzzle. In 2014, she and Lobel published a letter about the ability of European farmers to adapt to shocks brought on by climate change. At the start of 2015, Moore was the lead author of a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy titled "The Fingerprint of Climate Trends on European Crop Yields." So, we have lots to talk about. Frances Moore, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with your most recent paper about the fingerprint of climate change on Europe's crop yields. First of all, is there a problem with European crop production?
Well, so a lot of that kind of depends on exactly what you mean by problem. So on the one hand, the yields of important crops like wheat and barley are, you know, very high in Europe. They're among the highest in the world. But on the other hand, the yields also stopped growing around the early to mid-1990s. And so there's lots of possible explanations for why you saw this decline in the rate of yield growth. And so what we're trying to do in this paper is to tease out the effect of climate change.
It seems obvious that heat waves, drought, unusual rains will take their toll in farmers' fields. Why do we need to do the science to prove climate is a factor?
Yeah, so you know, you would expect climate to have an effect, but what you might expect is that it has a different effect in different places. So warmer temperatures might be more damaging in regions where it's already warm. And so what we're doing here is we are showing that climate change is a factor, but we're also quantifying the magnitude of that climate change effect and showing where it's had the biggest impact.
Before we get to your results, I would like to try to understand the methods you and Lobel used. In the abstract, you write, quote, "We show that statistical power for the identification of climate change impacts is high in many settings, but that power for identifying adaptation is almost always low. That has two parts. How can you use statistics to know if climate change is responsible for changes in the European growing conditions?"
Yes, so in order to determine whether changes in climate have had an effect on European agriculture, what we're using is the fact that temperature and rainfall changes haven't been the same across Europe. So some areas have warmed faster than others, and in addition, some regions have experienced a drying trend while others have gotten a little wetter. So we'd expect the impacts on crops to kind of vary spatially as a function of these different trends. So you can think of this as what we call the distinctive fingerprint of a changing climate on crop yields. And so we then compare this characteristic fingerprint against how yields actually change. And what we're finding is that they are statistically related. So that's how we come to this conclusion that climate change has affected crop yields in Europe.
In the second part, you say statistics don't work as well to see how farmers adapt to the new challenges. Why not?
Yeah, so in this case, figuring out adaptation is harder because what we're trying to compare is how yields should have changed if farmers were adapting with how they might have changed if they weren't adapting. And it turns out that those things aren't all that different. So that means the signal is pretty small. And then the noise in yield trends, so that this, all this unexplained variability in how yields are changing over time, is actually really large. And so the signal-to-noise ratio is just too small. And so we can't look at yields and tell whether or not farmers are adapting.
All right. Now, from this paper, what can we say about the impact of climate change on European crops?
Yeah, so what we find is that long-term climate trends have affected crop yields in Europe, but there's been very different impacts in different parts. So warmer and wetter growing seasons have generally been beneficial in northern Europe, while warmer and drier conditions have been harmful in southern Europe. So in aggregate, these effects balance out somewhat. So the overall effects are fairly small. So we've seen small benefits to maize and sugar beet yields and small declines of around 3 to 4% for wheat and barley yields. And so this is since 1989. So what this means is this can explain about 10% of the decline in yield growth rates, but really not the majority of it.
10%, that's not a lot for climate. What are some of the other factors, briefly?
Yeah, so it's definitely not the major part of the yield stagnation. And so we can't, say for sure what's causing the rest, but the ideas that are out there is that a lot of this is to do with major reforms to European farm subsidies over this time period. And in addition, the use of fertilizer has been more tightly regulated. And then it's also been hypothesized that there are these genetic limits to yield growth beyond which it's just technically impossible to improve yields. And the idea that Europe, kind of European, particularly wheat, might be approaching some of those limits.
Can we say with scientific certainty that the impacts of climate change on European agriculture will grow in the coming decades? And if so, what sort of changes would we expect?
Yes, well, I think you'll definitely see the signal of a changing climate, which we're already able to statistically identify in this paper. We'll certainly see it grow in coming decades as climate change progresses. And so what we know is that it's going to get hotter, and we know that wheat and barley in Europe seem to be particularly sensitive to warmer temperatures. So I think we'd expect to see yields of these crops grow more slowly or even start to decline as temperature increases.
Francis, do you happen to know the capacity of Europe to feed itself? In other words, if European crops are stagnating, even as the population grows, that rich continent will just import more food from other poorer countries. Are EU food imports growing, and is that an expected adaptation to climate change, perhaps?
Well, so Europe actually has a very productive agricultural sector at the moment, and it's actually an important exporter of wheat. So many countries in Europe, and in addition, you know, a lot of countries in Europe have a stable or even declining population. So the population growth is not necessarily a major concern. But I think what we worry more about is the idea that declining production might reduce the exports coming from Europe. And that could have a knock-on effect on global food prices. And that's very damaging for poorer consumers in developing countries.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Frances C. Moore from the Stanford School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences in California. And we're talking about Europe and how it feeds itself in the coming decades of climate change. Last year, you and David Lobel published a letter in the journal Nature Climate Change. The title is Adaptation Potential of European Agriculture in Response to Climate Change. How can we know what such a large number of diverse private farmers are doing in response to changes pushed by climate pressure?
Yeah, so in this paper, what we're looking at is what farmers could do in the future as climate change progresses in order to adapt to those changes. And so the way we estimate this is by comparing farmers in different locations. So a farmer in Spain knows that on average it's going to be hotter than, say, in Germany. So he should have made all these adjustments and investments so that he's getting the most he can out of farming in this hotter environment. And so if in the future the climate in Germany becomes similar to that in Spain, then it's likely this German farmer is going to try to make these same changes. And so by looking at this relation across spaces, this is how we quantify the potential effectiveness of adaptation.
And you talk about short-term and long-term adaptation by European farmers. And I found this very interesting. You said it's possible farmers could regard climate change like superstorms or heat waves or floods just as unusual weather. And if they do that and don't form a long-term plan, what happens?
Yeah, so this is what we call the short-run response function or the response to climate change that doesn't include adaptation. You can think of that as farmers just responding as though climate change is unusual weather. And what we find is this results in an almost universally negative response across Europe. So even northern areas in cooler parts of Europe, we might expect to benefit from warming, could see yield declines if farmers aren't adapting.
Yeah, your letter makes an unusual statement that, quote, overall profits could increase slightly under climate change. That's sort of the opposite of what we've been hearing from other sources. How could that happen?
Yeah, so when we're looking at profits rather than yield, what we're implicitly accounting for is that farmers have the opportunity to switch what they grow in response to climate change. So if you allow for the fact that farmers can make these adjustments, then the average effects across Europe may be very slightly positive. But you know, don't forget this is a mean effect, and so this average disguises the fact that there might be big differences across Europe. So farmers in the south are likely to lose out, whereas those in the north might benefit, even if they're able to adapt pretty well and to adjust what they grow.
And you talked about the possible barriers, say, with wheat, and I'm wondering whether if they can't adapt the staple crops that are currently grown to a hotter or wetter climate, maybe they might have to plant something else or even abandon farming in some areas.
Yeah, that was, I think, a pretty surprising result from this work is that the adaptation potential for wheat and barley seems to be fairly low. And so there's a couple possible, you know, responses to this. One is that, well, farmers of those crops might just move out of those crops and into slightly more heat-tolerant crops like maize as the climate warms. Another response might be to see this as an opportunity to invest now in research and development to start trying to develop some more heat-tolerant varieties to give farmers more adaptation options to keep farming wheat as the climate warms.
And I read through the reports of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to see what's projected for Europe. And their projections have been optimistic, generally, compared to the rate of climate change we've already seen. So what is your overall view of what will happen to European agriculture, say, by 2040? Is it a dark picture, or are we going to be all right?
I think a lot depends on this question of how quickly farmers are going to be able to adjust and adapt to the changes that we're going to see. And I think that's something we still don't have a particularly good estimate of. So if farmers are going to be able to adjust, then I think you'll see the distribution of crops that are being grown change over time. As I mentioned, perhaps more farmers switching away from wheat and barley and towards maize, which tends to do better in warmer conditions. And I think where water is available, you might also start to see increasing adoption of irrigation. What irrigation does, it helps reduce the adverse effect of high temperatures, but it also helps manage increasing rainfall variability that we expect to see with climate change. But if farmers aren't able to adapt quickly, then what you might see is more years of bad production, as well as possibly more variable production. And this could have a knock-on effect on the European grain exports and therefore on food prices, which is certainly detrimental to poor consumers around the world.
I noticed your research partner David Lobel published a paper finding that climate stress is linked to civil war in Africa. I guess if, as you say, Europe is not able to export as much food, that might be a further stress that could lead to conflict.
There are definitely a few papers now, David's work, but also people like Marshall Burke and Sol Fiang, who have published on this question. And they do seem to show a fairly robust relationship between high temperatures and increasing civil conflict. But what these papers don't really tell us is why you see this relationship. So what are the mechanisms that's driving this? And a possible cause is certainly through food prices. And it does seem to be the case that higher food prices are related to instances of civil unrest. And as an example, you saw this in 2007, 2008, where you saw a big spike in food prices that drove rioting in many areas of the world. So to the extent that adverse agricultural production in Europe is related to higher food prices, that could well be related to increased risk of civil conflict.
Why did you choose to study agriculture in Europe instead of the United States?
So that's interesting. So I went into this work looking for, trying to understand how farmers adapt to climate change. And what's interesting about Europe is that it's already seen fairly large magnitude of warming during the growing season. And so this is kind of in contrast to parts of the Midwest, you know, and the Corn Belt, which actually have this warming hole. So during the growing season, the warming trends have been very weak, if not slightly negative. And so there was not necessarily a great place to be looking for evidence of adaptation to climate change. And then in addition, in Europe, you've seen the stagnation of the important cereals, so wheat and barley. There was this hypothesis out there that's been driven by climate change. So both those reasons make this an interesting area to study.
Can you tell us, Francis, where your research is likely to go next?
Yeah, what I'd really like to do is use these maps of the climate change impacts to actually identify places to go and start talking to farmers. So in particular, we see areas of northern Italy seem to have been particularly badly hit by a combination of warming and drying trends. What I'd really like to do is go to Italy and start talking to farmers and to ask them, does this make sense to them? You know, have they experienced these yield trends? Have they noticed an effect on yield? And are they adapting to these trends?
And finally, I worry that scientific research into the impacts of climate change on agriculture are behind the rapid-moving facts on the ground. Can't we get enough science to policymakers and the agricultural industry in time to avert a really serious food crisis in the future?
I think climate change is definitely serious, but it's also, you know, one of only a number of challenges to the global food system over the next few decades. You know, also science doesn't necessarily have all the answers to these problems. I think many of these are political decisions that perhaps can be informed by science, but, you know, really need to also be made by an informed citizenry, kind of engaged with an elected representative.
We've been speaking with one of the bright young minds at Stanford University in California. Francis C. Moore is with the Stanford School of Earth, Energy, and Environmental Sciences. You can find links to the papers we've discussed in this program in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Francis, thank you so much for sharing your time and your mind with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. We've burned through all the time there is. Check out all our past shows as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org or find Radio EcoShock on SoundCloud. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening. Our music this week comes from Down Temple Dub, the remix album of music from Desert Dwellers. Find them at blackswansounds.com. It's great stuff.